Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be back in conversation today with one of our favorites, Dr. David Woolner, senior fellow and resident historian of the Roosevelt Institute, professor of history at Marist College, and senior fellow of the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College. Many will remember Dr. Woolner from our Power of Words series. He spoke to us about FDR's inaugural address. Dr. Woolner joins us today to talk about his new book, The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and Peace from Basic Books. Dr. Woolner is also the editor, co-editor of five books, and he has appeared on CNN, the BBC, Al Jazeera, and too many to name. He served as historical advisor to the Ken Burns film, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, the HBO BBC production, Churchill at War, and for numerous special exhibitions at the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. He sits on so many editorial boards, I'm not even going to tell you about them. Dr. Woolner also served as the Roosevelt Institute's executive director, overseeing a significant expansion of the organization's budget, programmatic dimension, and staff. He has a PhD in history from McGill University, a BA summa cum laude in English literature and history from the University of Minnesota. We'll talk to Dr. Woolner about all of this and much more, but first, welcome back, Dr. David Woolner.
Great to be here this morning.
Well, you're a great guy for coming up here and talking to us, because there is no thing that this radio station likes to do more than talk about Franklin Roosevelt. So the new book is The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and Peace. So do you think after all of this time he's become, you know, an intimate of yours?
Well, I've spent quite a few years now, almost two decades, living and working around Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt to a certain extent, with my relationship with the Roosevelt Institute, which, as you know, is based in part at Hyde Park at the FDR Presidential Library. So, you know, he's a mysterious fellow, Franklin Roosevelt. I think that makes him great fodder for historians, because we never quite know if we've got the essence of the man.
So when you say mysterious, what do you mean? Unknowable?
To a certain extent, unknowable. I mean, he kept himself to himself. He really was a very private person in many ways. You know, he has this reputation as being very effusive and very outgoing. And that's true, but in many respects, I think that was something of a mask. He kept his own counsel to a large extent, and in many ways is a kind of mystery. And so from that perspective, he's endlessly fascinating.
So you have the Depression, the early years of Franklin Roosevelt and what he did there, but this book is The Last 100 Days, and it is fascinating. I mean, all the people we wished we could have known, for example, Stalin. You know, he's meeting with him. He's meeting with Churchill. He's having people drop in on him, like Henry Morgenthau and all of the people who, you know, had different ideas about what to do with Germany after it was defeated. So I'm going to ask you questions. I'm going to name people. Mm-hmm. And that should be our departure, because I made three pages of notes reading the book, and I don't know how else we can do this. So we have a lot to do. Let's talk about it. First of all, Eleanor. Were they intimate partners other than intellectually?
Well, I think Franklin's relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt is a very important one. You know, it's a political partnership in many respects. She is primarily, at this point in his life, a political counselor. One of the things that you'll discover from reading this book is that, you know, Franklin is tired, he's exhausted, and he's kind of craving solace. I think his reluctance to run for a fourth term was genuine. He was somewhat ambivalent. On the other hand, he wanted to finish the war. And he's looking for relief from the pressures of office. And Eleanor is a policy advisor. I mean, you have to kind of imagine what the conversations are like between Bill and Hillary Clinton. You know, these are people that are very political in their outlook. And I think he started craving a relationship with Eleanor that was more based on a kind of man and wife relationship than this political one. And of course, she was impatient with him. Because near the end of his life, going into the fourth term, he was very concerned about getting conservative support for the United Nations. And many of his appointments, for example, at the State Department were conservative. Democrats and others she wasn't very particularly fond of. So she wasn't at all reluctant to be critical of him and some of his political appointments.
Henry Morgenthau.
Well, Henry Morgenthau is one of Franklin Roosevelt's oldest friends.
Secretary of Treasury.
Secretary of the Treasury. The proponent of the Morgenthau Plan in September of 1944, the idea to deindustrialize Germany. This also makes up a big part of the book, because there's a chapter dedicated on what I call the German problem, which is this notion, and we forget, that even at the end of the war, in spite of all the suspicion about the Soviet Union, you know, you can find organizations like the Society for the Prevention of World War III in New York City, a big organization dedicated not to Russia but to Germany. this idea that a kind of unified, powerful Germany was incompatible with world peace. So Morgenthau was not alone in that opinion. But of course, others in the Roosevelt administration, Cordell Hull, for example, and Henry Stimson, both argued you had to have a viable Germany to have a viable Europe after World War II.
So, and they certainly turned out to be right about that.
They did turn out to be right about that. And of course, Morgenthau was very angry and bitter, partly as a Jew, but also as a humanitarian at the kind of treatment that the Nazis had meted out to the Jews and others. So he was much more in favor of a much harsher peace. And in fact, you know, those decisions, like many decisions in the last 100 days, were kind of put on hold. I don't think FDR really came to a settled policy about Germany. He left it to the commanders on the ground.
One of the most fascinating parts of your book is when he met Ibn Saud, the Saudi Arabian king, and had to be sent over by winch because he couldn't walk either. And
that's right.
They found themselves liking each other because of this. They got along fabulously well. So that leads me to next question. Franklin Roosevelt and the Jews. Well, that's been very controversial over 1,000 years now.
Yes.
Over these last several years. What was Roosevelt's basic orientation towards Jewish people?
Well, I think Roosevelt was very much, you know, going right back to the 30s, Roosevelt was terribly concerned about the plight of the Jews in both Austria and Germany in the years that Hitler assumed power, and then again once the war broke out in Europe generally. I think it's a perfectly legitimate question to be critical of Roosevelt and his administration for the policies that they ended up pursuing during the 1930s and 40s. But I also think it's very important to keep these things in historical context. Most of his advisors argued vehemently that he should not, for example, try to reorient the U.S. Congress's 1924 National Origins Act because it probably would end up being more restrictive.
And what was that, Dave?
That was a law that was essentially nativist. We're seeing a lot of this, of course, in today's world, that was designed to kind of roll back immigration in Europe, particularly from the Southeastern Europe and from Russia, where you had a lot of Catholic, Italian, and Southeastern European immigration, and millions of people, actually, and then, of course, many, many Russian Jews coming into the country. And, you know, you see this nativist reaction to this, the revival of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, in the 1920s. Obviously, they are extremely anti-black, but in this particular period, they were railing against Catholics and Jews. So Roosevelt was in a very hostile environment. You know, we have to remember that there was tremendous anti-Semitism in the country, including within the State Department. And Roosevelt did what he could, probably could have done more in some respects, but the political environment was very hostile to him.
Winston Churchill.
Well, his relationship with Churchill is endlessly fascinating. One of the things that's very interesting about the book is how Roosevelt has essentially shifted over to his focus is now on Joseph Stalin. It doesn't mean that he isn't fond of Winston Churchill and doesn't have great respect for him.
But Churchill has gone into third place.
He's gone into third place. Roosevelt recognizes that the British Empire and the whole notion of imperialism is a thing of the past.
But Churchill didn't accept that.
Churchill did not accept that. And much of the war, as far as he was concerned, was about the restoration of Great Britain and the British Empire. And Roosevelt, of course, saw that as a complete anachronism. So in many respects, Stalin becomes the more reliable partner. In spite of all of the disappointing developments that occurred in the immediate post-war years, we should remember that Great Britain was also an imperial power. Churchill went to see Stalin in October 44 to essentially secure British hold on southeastern Europe to a certain extent, and particularly Greece and the eastern Mediterranean. They were cutting what were called the percentages deals, where Churchill acquiesced in Soviet control over Romania and Bulgaria, for example, whereas Britain would get a hold of Greece. And we also forget that in the public mind, they were equal problems. In other words, the press was covering both the Soviet, the indication that the Soviet Union was going to dominate Poland and the British intervention in Greece is essentially part of the same problem.
Interesting. So as long as you've mentioned it, David Woolner, let's talk about the Polish problem. That dominated a good deal of Roosevelt's time, didn't it?
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. And of course, it makes up a good share of the book, particularly when we're talking about the conference at Yalta. I think what's very important to understand here is that the United States, while concerned about Poland, and it's interesting, it's also very much the case with Great Britain. Poland is a huge problem for both Franklin Roosevelt and for Winston Churchill. Stalin was very consistent with his insistence that he had to have a kind of buffer zone in Eastern Europe. I mean, he started these conversations in 1941 as they're first negotiating sending supplies to him. So he's very consistent about that.
And he was angry because he was doing all the work, he felt, during the war.
Yeah.
The other guys weren't carrying their share.
That's exactly right. I mean, 90% of the German battle casualties were inflicted by the Red Army. The United States and Britain, of course, fought gallantly in this war and deserve great credit. But in terms of the defeat of Nazi Germany, that was Russia's doing. And I think we forget that while both Churchill and Roosevelt hoped for a measure of democracy, they understood that the Soviet Union was going to need a kind of sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. And it's interesting. In the book, there's some discussion of Roosevelt's relationship with Premier Beneš, the Czechoslovakian leader, who negotiated an agreement with Stalin at the end of the war that allowed for political independence at home, but an understanding that the Soviet Union would have some say over Czech foreign policy because, of course, the Russians were terrified of the Germans. We keep forgetting that Germany was the problem at that point. And from Stalin's perspective, what he wants from both the British and the Americans is the continued cooperation to hold back Germany once this war is over.
The book we are talking about is The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and Peace by David Woolner. It is a terrific book, and you're going to love it because it really does bring it all together. And David, if we can, let's go on with my testing you by asking you specific questions about people. I've often wondered, what did FDR really think about Hitler?
That's a very good question. Roosevelt is unique. You know, when he first became president in 1933, he invited foreign leaders to come to Washington, and the British Prime Minister came, and the Premier of France, and so forth. And in April of 1933, to the French Premier, he said that Adolf Hitler was a madman. Really, from day one, he recognized that Hitler was an incredibly dangerous force.
So was he unique in having that perspective?
I think so. You know, I think Roosevelt has a public persona and he has a private persona. And as a public figure and as a leader, he can only go so far on issues like, for example, persecution of the Jews. He can only go so far on opposing Nazism. There's tremendous isolationism in the country. People don't want to get back involved in European affairs. They think that Europe is dedicated to colonialism and empire, and the United States is not going to support that kind of activity. So there's a kind of anti-British, anti-European sentiment in this country that we forget about. It's interesting. It doesn't apply to Asia. The public was much more willing to see the United States take a stronger stand against Japanese aggression in China, for example, in the 1930s, but very, very reluctant to get involved in the struggles in Europe. So Roosevelt's hands are largely tied, but he recognized that Hitler was absolutely bent on conquest. And let's remember that Kristallnacht, Franklin Roosevelt, the terrible night of broken glass that the Nazis inflicted on the Jews in 1938, the United States was the only country in the world to recall its ambassador. Franklin Roosevelt was the only major leader in the world to denounce that the next day. And in roughly the same time, shortly thereafter, he got a group of senators together and he said to General Marshall at the time that, you know, having additional army troops in Kansas was not going to do anything to stop Hitler. He wanted 5,000 planes a year. You know, he wanted to build up a major air force. He thought that that would deter the Nazis. He clearly had turned a page by then in terms of wanting to be much more assertive in opposing Hitler. But in terms of the public perception, you know, the public wasn't ready for it yet. So he had to hedge, you know, had to hold himself back to a certain extent.
So David Woolner, I guess the next question is, what is his relationship with his senior advisors? One of the guys that I'm most interested in and who doesn't get a lot of play in the world, but you mentioned, is Alvin Barkley, who becomes a vice president with Truman, but who also played a critical role in Roosevelt getting his stuff through the Congress because he was the majority leader.
That's right. Barkley is an important figure, and there's a wonderful scene in the book in which Barkley comes to the White House to see FDR. And one of the reasons I decided to write this book is because I think the public just doesn't realize here's a man who can't get out of bed in the morning, who is really confined to a wheelchair, and, you know, yet is running a major country and overseeing a global war. And how in the world does he do it? And he's also been ordered by his physicians to cut his workload to 4 hours a day, which, of course, was completely absurd. You can't be president of the United States and work 4 hours a day running a global war. And Roosevelt, frankly, never did cut his workload to 4 hours a day. But Barclay's an important figure, and there's this wonderful scene in the book where Barclay comes to the White House to see Roosevelt the morning of the Yalta speech, because there's no time. He's come back from Yalta, 14,000-mile trip the day before. He's about to go over to Congress to deliver his Yalta address. And the only time that he can see the president is in the morning, early in the morning of that same day. So he greets Roosevelt in the bathroom. And Roosevelt's sitting there in his wheelchair shaving. And the president says, sit down. And of course, you know, the only place to sit down was a certain quote-unquote functional stool, Barclay notes in his memoirs, and has this incredible conversation with Roosevelt, very animated, and telling him about the Yalta conference, telling him about Stalin, telling him about the decisions that were made at Yalta. And Barclay says that, you know, every time he would lather his face, he would get distracted and talk away. And then, of course, the lather would dry up and he'd have to do it all over again. So he re-lathered his face about five times that morning. And, of course, what Roosevelt is trying to do, and again, we forget this, there's no guarantee that the Congress is going to support the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, for most...
He certainly remembered what happened to Woodrow Wilson.
Absolutely. And I think it's also important to understand that when we talk about the United Nations, we're not just talking about the broader organization dedicated to human rights and public welfare and social policy and so forth. We're also talking about the Security Council and the so-called four policemen. And for Roosevelt, this is critical. As far as he is concerned, the way to prevent another cataclysmic war. And one of the convictions I've had for years working so closely with Roosevelt is I think the level of violence meted out in the Second World War. And I'm not just talking about the Germans. I'm talking about the firebombing of Hamburg and Tokyo and Dresden and so forth. Even before the atomic bomb, the level of violence is so horrific and intense that I think Roosevelt was absolutely convinced the world could not survive a Third World War. And he wants to prevent that from happening. And for, as far as he was concerned, bringing the Soviet Union into the international community, not as some kind of social democratic Sweden. Let's not kid ourselves. Roosevelt's not that naive. He understands that Stalin is a brutal dictator. But he also understands that having an isolated, paranoid, very powerful state that is on its own and not a part of the world community is a tremendous risk. So he needs to draw them into this world community. And the instrument he uses to do that is the Security Council of the United Nations. So as far as he's concerned, it's absolutely critical not only to figure out a way to draw the Soviets in from a geopolitical perspective, which means hard bargaining at places like Yalta over issues like Poland, but it's also critical to gain the support of the American people and the U.S. Congress. And so Barclay, for example, is a key figure here. He needs that support in Congress for these provisions in order to get the United Nations up and running. And it's also interesting, you know, he wasn't planning to go and stay in San Francisco at that opening conference. He wanted to go there, address them, and he told Morgenthau this, I'm going to address them in my wheelchair, which I think is very, very telling, and leave. And he wanted that initiative to move forward, in a sense, without him, so that the Congress and the American people and the world community would, in a sense, launch this new organization that he thought was so critical to world peace.
In reading your book, I keep getting the feeling that had not, because you spend a lot of time on Yalta and the trip, which is so fascinating, and a Roosevelt on the trip with him, having an affair with a U.S. ambassador, but really the gatekeeper and the person who really looked out for FDR more than anybody else. But I want to ask you a question. Had he not gone to Yalta, do you think he could have lived longer?
That's a very, very tough question and a very good question. He was clearly a dying man. And in one of the, you know, people asked me, should he have run in some respects for that fourth term? You know, I say yes, in a sense, because I think those few months were absolutely vital to the post-war world. On the other hand, it was irresponsible of him. He clearly was in ill health. He had been warned by his physicians that he had had heart disease. He was aware that he was at the beginning stages of congestive heart failure. But I think he absolutely was determined to see the war through and to see the United Nations get established so that he made the decision to run. You know, one of the points I make in the book is that the really critical decision was not 1944, but 1940, when he decided to run for a third term, because there's a fascinating conversation that Eleanor Roosevelt has with Margaret Fairweather, where she says he understood that when he ran in 1940 that it might shorten his life, but that he made the decision to proceed anyway. So it's clear to me that he understood that he was a man who, and as he once said, could crack up at any moment, but absolutely was determined to finish the work that he had set out to do, and so ran in spite of all the risks.
What about Harry Truman? He brings in this fairly obscure senator who had done good work, anti-corruption work in the Congress, but it's always been fascinating that with all the guys he was encouraging to run, he was always playing those games, Truman becomes his guy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's also a factor here that Roosevelt is kind of exhausted. He wants to get this job done. He doesn't want a major political fight over Henry Wallace.
Now, Henry Wallace, we should remember, of course, was regarded by the American left as being their guy. I've talked to Pete Seeger about it and other people, and this was the guy they were all out there supporting. But he just was a no-go, right? I mean, he had outlived his usefulness.
I think it's interesting. I think, you know, if you look at Wallace's career, there's no question that Franklin Roosevelt had enormous respect for Henry Wallace. He didn't make him vice president and again, that's the critical year. When he decides to run in 1940, he tells Jim Farley, I could die at any time. And who does he pick? He picks Wallace. At that point, he
doesn't pick Farley, that's for sure.
No, that's for sure. And he's interested in maintaining the New Deal. And Wallace is the guy to do that. But in 1944, he doesn't want to have a political fight on his hands because he's got to get that United Nations through the Congress and so forth. And Wallace is just too far to the left for, you know, the sort of mainstream political bosses of the Democratic Party. He's very popular among the political left. He's very popular among a lot of rank-and-file Democrats. But he's a political liability as far as the Democratic Party leadership was concerned at the time. And they, to a certain extent, they kind of forced Roosevelt's hand.
So why Truman?
Safe. He was a safe candidate. He was a centrist candidate. You know, he was a known figure, but not a hugely known figure. And again, I think part of what you see in the book is Roosevelt's exhaustion comes through here because Truman is, you know, he sees Truman twice in that 100 days. He's barely informed about what's going on in Roosevelt's foreign policy.
Irresponsible of him not to tell him about the atomic bomb?
Yeah, I think it was. Although, you know, I make the point here, too, when you look at the last 100 days, Roosevelt's hardly in the White House. You know, he's constantly trying to get relief from the pressures of office. And then, of course, he's away for almost 6 weeks going to Yalta. So he's gone a good share of that 100 days. And that doesn't, of course, provide him an opportunity to speak to Truman about things like the atomic bomb.
Now, there have been people who I know you think have taken liberties because basically Roosevelt was, like all the rest of us who are in one gender area, a man. You know, there was this film recently which just blatantly says that Roosevelt was having various lovers, including his cousin and his secretary and all the rest. And you don't think it was physical?
No, I don't. I think Franklin Roosevelt, you know, from 1921, he had been confined essentially to a wheelchair. He's a man with a tremendous disability. And it's really, I don't think, in his character. Speaking strictly from the record, you know, there's no way of knowing, for example, 100% whether or not he had a physical relationship with Lucy Mercer, who became Lucy Rutherford. But the strong circumstantial evidence that they had an affair and strong circumstantial evidence that he loved her and she loved him. But, you know, his relationship with her, like his relationship with Daisy in the last 100 days and in this period of his life, even in the 1940s, you know, when he's in the White House, it's emotional support. And it's a funny thing. You know, we should not forget that Eleanor had the same kinds of relationships. She had her confidants. He had his confidants.
And Eleanor, and both women and men.
That's correct. And Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, liked the company of women who didn't place demands on him. You know, the problem for Franklin Roosevelt is he's tired, he's exhausted, and people come to see him with an agenda. Everybody has an agenda. And he wants to be able to sit in a room, you know, and relax. But he wants company. And there are very few people that can provide that. And one of the things that comes through in the book is these last few close friends that he has.
And Harry Hopkins let him down, according to him. He and Anna, the daughter, were infuriated when Hopkins, who was dying himself, decides he has to fly rather than stay on the ship and go back to Virginia.
That's right.
So what does he do? He's mad. He's mad about his friend.
He's very angry at Hopkins for leaving, flying from North Africa back to the United States, eventually going to the Mayo Clinic. You know, he would never see Roosevelt again. I think that was unfair of the president, but it shows you how, you know, again, he needed these people. He was very nervous and concerned about his ability to bring Congress around to supporting the United Nations. And Hopkins was going to be the key person to help him write that speech. And Hopkins left. And in fact, everybody that was at Yalta, all his key aides had responsibilities and they had to leave him So what Roosevelt does is he flies down Sam Roseman, one of his speechwriters from London, who wasn't even at Yalta. And he's the one who sails across the Atlantic with the president and helps him work on the speech. But of course, Roseman is very frustrated because Franklin Roosevelt falls into a kind of depression after his aide Paul Watson dies, and basically just day after day just sits on the deck sort of brooding and won't work on the speech until basically 24, 48 hours before he's due back in Virginia. So it's very interesting. And, you know, there are these few people. Daisy Sukley was one that he could relax with. And, you know, people understood this. Eleanor understood this. She was glad that Daisy was with Franklin. She would ask Daisy to stay with her husband to keep him company because it wasn't something that she was particularly interested in. She had her own political agenda to oversee, and she was a very active woman. And, you know, we forget, he is in a wheelchair. He's stuck in that second floor study in the White House. He's stuck there. Daisy Sukley comes in and has lunch and dinner with him on a tray.
Well, not to be crass about this, but one can have sexual relief other than by having intercourse. And there are many people who think that's exactly what happened between him, his secretary, you know, Daisy. And you just simply don't believe it, and you don't have the evidence, nor do I. But I do know one thing. He was a powerful man. He had an ego. Fits the paradigm of somebody who would need that.
Well, you're certainly entitled to your opinion, but I think that what he was seeking was emotional solace, and I think that for Eleanor's sake, that was more of a betrayal than anything physical.
Does it have to be one or the other? Well, in any case, let's talk a little bit about General of the Army George Marshall. Here was the President of the United States running a war. How much did he depend on Marshall?
Marshall was a critical figure in the Roosevelt administration, a brilliant man, and one who, you know, there's a famous scene in the late 1930s when Marshall is in the White House with a number of other senior officers, and they're all sort of agreeing with the president, and Marshall kind of pipes up from the back of the room saying, "I totally disagree," and completely disavows the arguments that the president had just made. And as they leave, his senior officers say to him, "Well, there goes your career, George." And, of course, Roosevelt reaches down and pulls Marshall up from the mid-ranks and makes him chief of staff of the Army. And Marshall refused to laugh at Roosevelt's jokes, refused to vote, and refused to call him Franklin, always called him Mr. President. So he's a very, very critical figure for the entire war period and someone that Franklin Roosevelt absolutely relied on.
Did he ever second-guess Marshall? I mean, there were critical decisions made about where you go, how you do it, Soviets and all the rest.
It's interesting. Roosevelt, of course, has to take into consideration the political aspects of the war, not just the military and strategic. And, of course, the most important decision that Roosevelt makes is the decision to invade North Africa in 1942, which pulls the United States into the Mediterranean theater, which is exactly what Marshall said it would do, and, of course, delays any possibility, ultimately, of invading France until 1944.
But he did it because Stalin was so insistent that a second front be opened.
That's right, and he did it because the American public was so engaged in the war against the Pacific that Franklin Roosevelt was worried that the sort of momentum of the war would shift. And, you know, American wartime policy,
Germany first.
Was based on Germany first. And that was the greater threat as far as the Americans were concerned. And we're fighting this war in the Pacific, and the public is angry at the Japanese because of Pearl Harbor. So he needed to psychologically get the country focused on the European theater. And the only place to do that in 1942 was North Africa.
Let me bring you back a little earlier than your book, which is David Woolner's The Last 100 Days, a brilliant analysis, by the way, of FDR and what had happened to him. But even before that 100 days was the taking of the Japanese and putting them into some kind of, what some people would call concentration camps. Was that consistent with the FDR you know?
Absolutely not. I think it was a huge mistake. I think Roosevelt shouldn't have done it. It's one of the blackest marks on his otherwise quite stellar career.
Yeah, but he's so brilliant. Why did he do it?
Well, he was convinced by the War Department that there was a threat. It's interesting when you look at the documents. The FBI argued that there was no serious threat, that any Japanese that might be a risk to the public safety had been already arrested. There's just a handful. The same with, by the way, with Germans and Italians. The Justice Department absolutely refused to execute the policy because they said it was unconstitutional.
Well, it got executed. There were an awful lot of people in those camps.
That's right. Well, the War Department insisted on it. And so Franklin Roosevelt, in the midst of this war, and I think in the midst of the fear, and that's another thing that we need to place this in context, again, not to justify it, But we forget that the United States of 1941, 42 is not the United States of 1945 or today. There was tremendous concern about the possibility of a Japanese invasion of the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
The Pacific Fleet had been decimated at Pearl Harbor. We felt very defenseless. And there was a kind of hysteria in the country about this 100,000-plus Japanese population on the West Coast. And very importantly, you know, senior columnists like Walter Lippmann were arguing publicly in the New York Times and elsewhere for this kind of policy. So Roosevelt wasn't alone in making this terrible mistake.
Well, if there's one thing Franklin Roosevelt has been called by many people, it's being a pragmatist. He did what he had to do in order to get to a particular point. And this is a good example of pragmatism.
It is a good example of pragmatism. And it's unfortunate. It should have never happened. He did create the Nisei Regiment in 1943, the Japanese-American regiment that became the most decorated in Second World War that fought in Italy. You know, there's extraordinary
sure.
stories about that. So there are flip sides to this story, but there's no excusing it. It was a terrible, terrible thing to do.
Do you think at any level he ever knew that?
I think eventually he did. Eleanor certainly did. And she, by the way, refused to criticize him once the decision was made. We need to understand that. Once the decision was made, she never publicly spoke out against it. She started to slowly work against the policy a year or two later. She visited the camps and she would do things to indicate that the policy should be modified. And then she would eventually argue that the camp should be closed, and so would the Justice Department. And that process started to happen.
Again, the book is David B. Woolner, The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. I want to go back to Stalin, because I find him incredibly interesting. You know, he's been portrayed as a brutal, terrible man. There's a story that's around that when FDR called Stalin about the rape of German women, Stalin said, "Are you kidding, you know, what these Nazis did to our population?" And of course, he just literally hung up on him, on FDR, on this thing. What is your make as you read all the stuff about Yalta and everything else? What is your make about the character of Stalin?
Stalin is a very shrewd and sophisticated man. And, you know, of the three, he is the sharpest intellectually at Yalta, in the sense that both Churchill and Roosevelt are showing signs of age. I don't think this affected their judgment. One of the things that was very interesting to me is to see how Franklin Roosevelt literally reiterates word for word State Department policy papers that he had been given prior to the war at Yalta. So he's clearly on top of things, and he's clearly in charge. That's the other thing, the point I make in the book. He is in charge.
And he has a perfect foil in Churchill, right? Because
exactly.
Because Churchill wants to reestablish his empire. FDR is not going to let that happen.
Exactly.
And that's got to be of some pleasure to Stalin.
Yeah. But listen, Stalin is very consistent. There's two things that we need to remember. One is he persistently and consistently asked from day one for a buffer zone in Western Europe. The thing that wasn't determined is, what's that buffer zone going to look like? Is it going to be sort of semi-democratic with some measure of autonomy, like Finland, for example? Or is it going to be, a brutally oppressed? And, you know, the situation is that because the United States and Great Britain couldn't get into Europe until 1944, what essentially could have happened through negotiation earlier on. And again, remember, Franklin Roosevelt in 1941-42 is thinking the United States will be stronger to negotiate, be in a stronger position at the end of the war, and he would prefer to negotiate then. They called it the policy of procrastination. But, you know, the opposite is also true. So is Stalin. And what eventually happens is that the Soviets determine that they will simply assume authority for Eastern Europe, and particularly for Poland, by virtue of the military reality of having the boots on the ground.
So David Woolner, to put it differently, was Stalin an ogre?
Yeah, he's a brutal dictator. But the hardcore reality is, and again, I cannot stress this enough. I mean, look at George Marshall, for example. There's a wonderful quote in the book from the Joint Chiefs of Staff from the early April, I think it's April 2nd, 1945, where reflecting on Soviet behavior in Poland and Romania, the Joint Chiefs, this is not the president, the Joint Chiefs say that while Soviet behavior is despicable, it is of relatively minor moment. I mean, you know, as far as they're concerned, you have to understand the nature of this war, the destructive power of this war. You can't go to war with Russia. It's impossible. And you can't win the war without Russia. So they had to swallow a lot of unpleasantries in order to achieve this victory over fascism. And I think the expectation was, it's not naivete. It's the recognition of the reality of the moment.
You can't beat Hitler without him.
can't beat Hitler without him. There's a manpower shortage in the United States. We forget that. That comes up a lot in the book. You know, we're stretched to the max because we have all this industry that we need to support. We have all the logistics. So you can't win this war without the Russians. And you hope that you'll be able to ameliorate the situation over time. That's what I think Roosevelt was working towards. But if it comes right down to it, if it's a choice between having to decide between a full democratic Poland and having the Soviet Union continue its cooperation through the United Nations, there's no question, not only in Roosevelt's mind, but also among the Joint Chiefs, we have to keep this cooperation going with the Russians until the war is over. And let's hope that as time goes on, we can moderate their policies. I think that was the expectation. And don't forget, as far as the Joint Chiefs of Staff are concerned, it's absolutely vital to get the Russians in the war against Japan.
Let me throw you another name, the guy who goes on to be governor of New York and who has tremendous wealth himself, Averell Harriman. What role did he play in all of this?
Harriman was a very critical player in the book. He is the ambassador that Roosevelt chooses to be in the Soviet Union. You know, Roosevelt didn't have a great deal of respect for the State Department or for the professional diplomats, so he chose his envoys at critical positions very carefully. And as this relationship with Stalin is becoming more and more important, he puts Harriman in place in Moscow as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. And Harriman reports directly to the president. So it's a direct line of communication, as was the case really with London and other key.
Now, I always thought of Harriman as a bit of a stiff, but, you know, this critical position would indicate otherwise.
No, it's true. And Harriman is very important. Harriman, he's realistic when it comes to Russia. He's one of the ones who starts arguing for a quid pro quo that we should, especially near the end, that he's concerned about Russian behavior. And I think Roosevelt was too. But again, Roosevelt is playing the long game. He's always playing this long game. And he's trying to balance out all of these competing demands. And it's unfortunate. I mean, there's no question it's unfortunate, for example, the way events play out in Poland. But again, you have to remember that as far as things like Greece and the arrangements that Churchill had negotiated with Stalin at near the end of the war, Stalin lived up to his agreements. It isn't until the instigation of the Marshall Plan and the U.S. rehabilitation of Germany that we really see Stalin turning against the understandings that had been achieved with the Americans and the British at the end of the war.
Well, because he thought that, you know, he was going to get more than he actually got.
And also the concern was Germany. How can you rebuild Germany, this country that has, you know, over 20 million dead in Russia? The devastation is visceral. And, you know, even today when you travel in Russia, you see the monuments, you see the markers outside of the city of Moscow where the farthest point in where the German tanks were stopped. It's a very telling experience for the Russians.
David Woolner wrote this great book, The Last 100 Days, FDR, War and Peace, and it tells us so much. Let's go to Anna Roosevelt, back to Anna Roosevelt. She had a tremendous amount of power. Eleanor was, of course, furious, as everybody knows, when she brought Lucy Mercer down to Warm Springs after she had been promised that affair was never going to happen, you know, again. How did Anna come out of all of this?
It's a very interesting story, and I think it says a lot about Roosevelt's state of mind and health in the last 2 years, or a year or so of his life, and particularly in the last 100 days. Anna's a critical figure. She's the one who raises the largest alarm. So did Eleanor, but Anna's really the one who's so concerned about his health that he gets this major medical checkup in the spring of 1944 after the Tehran conference. This is when they discover that he has congestive heart failure, or when it's confirmed, and he gets on to digitalis and so forth and so on. And so she becomes a very critical inside player. In some ways, she almost becomes, as you said earlier, his gatekeeper.
And of all the children, she certainly is the exemplary one.
That's right.
And others, not so much.
Yes, and she dedicates herself to her father and his health and trying to make his life and keep him going, so to speak. What's interesting is that, you know, she almost becomes a political figure in that sense, you know, because she, in some respects, steps in between him and Harry Hopkins, for example, at Yalta, which is very unusual.
How
when
so?
Hopkins has to go to Anna to get...
I see.
You know, he's sort of confined to his bed, so he's not very mobile. He does go to the meetings. Hopkins does go to the plenary sessions at the Yalta conference. But, you know, he's very concerned about Roosevelt's relationship with Churchill. He's very concerned about the negotiations over the UN. He asks, and he goes to Anna to try to get things moving in the way that he wants. And she basically, you know, says, well, we'll see, you know, and she would report back to her father. So it's a fascinating story. When they get back to Washington, she begins to tell people that all but major decisions should be run through her and her husband so that they can try to keep, you know, extra work away from her father, you know, which is an extraordinary role to play. She's not really successful in that because there's a whole White House apparatus that understands that the president has to be reached. But she plays a very important role.
So history has treated her, at least the way that I see it. So she brings Lucy Mercer down to Warm Springs. So what? He deserved that. Eleanor had her own life going on with bodyguards and, you know, friends and Valkill and all the rest of it. What in hell was wrong with bringing Mercer down there?
Well, again, I think because Franklin Roosevelt had promised that he would never see her again way back in the early 1920s.
For good reason, because Mama said she would disinherit and because of all of that stuff.
And I think that what you see is that there is continued contact between the two of them by letter and so forth through those years, but it's not very intense and it's not very frequent and it's mostly by letter. And I think it's very telling that here again in this last period of his life, in the last 100 days, he's reaching out to her by phone, to Lucy by phone. He's trying to see her as much as possible. Every time Eleanor's away, basically.
He's in love with her.
He's in love with her, and she's in love with him. But it's not the kind of thing that he would admit to anybody. I mean, the ironic thing is the only person that he would confide any of this to or even given any indication to was Daisy Sukley, who is justifiably called Franklin Roosevelt's most intimate companion. I mean,
How did he choose her? According to what I've read and seen, all of a sudden she gets a letter saying, come visit me. Is that right?
Yeah, they're Hudson Valley neighbors. She's from Rhinebeck. He's from Hyde Park. They both in prominent families. They'd known each other since they were teenagers, and they have developed this very comfortable relationship that, you know, she's just incredibly discreet. She's not the kind of person that's going to speak about anything that any of the conversations that go on between the two of them.
And they have hundreds of letters to prove.
Yeah, and he basically can unwind. And she's, you know, one of the very few people that he could unwind and unburden himself to. She's one of these people, again, who did not have an agenda.
What about the sons? I mentioned them almost disparagingly before. My congressman, when I was growing up on the west side of Manhattan, was Franklin Jr. You know, a lot of people thought, well, that name was so magical that he would be the congressman, of course, and he was. But they couldn't get where some other people who had famous parents got.
That's true. That's true. I mean, I think it was a tough life being, I think, the son of Franklin Roosevelt. And the two of them were so political and so involved, and so was Eleanor, that I think there is a certain amount of, maybe neglect is too strong a word, but these children were, to a certain extent, on their own, and they were in what they used to call the fishbowl and public eye all the time. And so it was difficult for them. They went through many different marriages and so forth and so on. So they had a hard time kind of recasting themselves in a role that would be similar to their famous father.
So when history looks at Franklin Roosevelt, and you've been spending all your time, you know, working with him, around him, not that you really knew him because you're much too young, but when history looks at him, have they got it right?
I think so. I mean, I think there's some things in the book that I think that are highlighted that are not typically raised, the public is not so much aware of. I think, for example, his mission to see Ibn Saud in 1945 was very serious. He was really determined to try to see what he could do to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. I think that's underappreciated. He was advised, every one of his advisors, military and otherwise.
So there are too many Arabs and too few Jews.
Exactly, and when we need the oil. We forget that the oil was becoming a major issue. In 1943, they determined the United States was using more oil than it was producing. So everyone was against it. Everyone. And he asked many, many people, but he went ahead with it anyway. And I think because he thought that he had this personal power of persuasion that he might be able to convince the king that he should take a more accommodating view of this idea. And of course, he failed miserably, and he called it his great failure of his career. And then, you know, the other thing about Franklin Roosevelt, of course, he's been accused of giving away too much at Yalta and so forth and so on. But I think that if you look at the incredibly complicated world that he had inherited and the challenges, political, military and otherwise, that he was facing, he shows extraordinary leadership. And to think that he, you know, managed to do as much as he did, even though he was in serious decline physically and serious health problems, it's just an extraordinary story.
Now, I want to get to something else for a couple of minutes, but before I do, I want to ask you a diagnostic question. Is there anyone that Franklin Roosevelt chose to rely on that you have second doubts about? You've mentioned Henry Wallace, of course, who caused them some trouble, but of the group, of the secretaries of state, of the George Marshalls, of all the other guys, is there anybody who you think he could have chosen better?
Well, I think, you know, his disdain for the State Department, or his sort of ignoring that institution and trying to do things on his own, while admirable in many respects and necessary because of the entrenched views of Congress often and the entrenched views of the bureaucracy, is something that one could criticize.
Except that you've already said that the State Department was, for example, anti-Semitic.
That was one of the points I was going to raise. Right. I mean, he might have tried to do more to clean house, for example, get rid of someone like Breckinridge Long, who really thwarted the ability of German and Austrian Jews to get into the countries in the 1930s. Again, we need to, the facts are, and this is a difficult subject, but you know, in spite of all of the restrictions, the United States between 1936 and 1940 took in more German and Jewish, Austrian and German Jewish refugees than any other country in the world during those years. That doesn't mean it was enough. It doesn't mean that we met the quota. It doesn't mean we couldn't have done more. But I think it is important to recognize that part of that came about as a result of a quiet order that Roosevelt issued in 1935, which changed the status of refugees from the bottom of the immigration heap to the top. And once that happened, it was possible for refugees, Jewish refugees in particular, to get immigration papers into the United States.
David B. Woolner wrote The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. Okay, David, I've been saving this to last because I know you've been thinking about it. We have a president of the United States, Donald Trump, and your perspective, having analyzed the life and times of FDR, I know you've been writing about this, and I know you've been thinking about this, but what are the lessons that Roosevelt has given us that we might use for comparative analysis with Donald Trump?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of Roosevelt's perspective on the world, what needs to be understood is that when Roosevelt articulated the Four Freedoms in January of 1941, even before we were in the war, you know, he brings up this notion that we want to see a world based on these four fundamental freedoms. We want to see freedom of speech and expression. We want to see the freedom of every person to worship God in their own way, freedom of religion. But very, very important, he brings up the issue of freedom from want. And I think what we need to understand about Franklin Roosevelt is that he recognized very early on that the security and well-being of people around the world was directly tied to the security and well-being of the United States. So, you know, as he said in his famous Economic Bill of Rights speech in 1944, you know, we've come through this war, learned some hard lessons. And necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff with which dictatorships are made. So there's this recognition that, you know, we need to care about the rest of the world, that the United States has to commit itself, not only in a military sense, but in an economic and moral sense, to a global engagement. And in that sense, I think the biggest change, the biggest difference, is this America First emphasis of the current administration, which I think is a mistake.
But both men have personalities, and that I find far more interesting even than the profound thing you've just said, which is that one is, at least I think, a complete egotist and, you know, basically a person who thinks of his own needs before that of the country. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, unfortunately, in many respects. You know, one of the great issues when you're talking about presidency is the question of ego and the question of a certain amount of humility and understanding the nature of the office. I think what Mr. Trump has forgotten is that he's not just head of government, he's head of state. And he needs to recognize that. And one of the key roles, and I point this out in the book, that, you know, part of the reason that job is so exhausting is that you are both. You're not simply the head of government. You're also the head of state. And that means you have to think about the broad political spectrum in front of you. Think about the American people as a whole. You cannot let, you know, your personal animosities and ego get in the way of that function of the office. And I think we've seen time and time again that this current president, you know, he tweets before he thinks.
I'm not so sure. I think he has a kind of, put a better way, an evil genius understanding what those tweets are going to do.
Well, he certainly understands that by being outrageous, he gets the media attention and he gets media distraction. I think one of the great challenges of the media now is to the extent to which they can ignore Donald Trump. I always find that if you're watching a broadcast or you have great radio stations like WAMC or PBS and NPR that run the real news around the world, what's happening in Kenya, what's happening in Zimbabwe, what's happening in the United States. And by the way, President Trump just tweeted about some other basketball issue or something. You know, these are not the major stories of the day. And I think that the media has a big responsibility to figure out how to put those issues in a box and make sure the American people are engaged with the serious problems and issues that they're confronting, not just the United States, but the entire world today. We're living in a very difficult and dangerous time.
You bet.
I think is very similar to the 1930s. You know, the 1930s was an era when international cooperation had broken down, international trade had broken down, and we see the consequence of that. And I think, you know, Roosevelt famously said, it's not remembered in that Four Freedoms Address, that peace cannot be bought at the price of other people's freedom. And I think, you know, by ignoring the well-being of other parts of the world and putting America first, as we say, we're actually putting America second.
Well, our guest has been the incredible David B. Woolner, senior fellow and resident historian of the Roosevelt Institute, professor of history at Marist College, senior fellow of the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, and author of The Last 100 Days, FDR, War and Peace. So in any case, David, thank you very much. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time, and you really have given us a great deal to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.